From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. The number of children diagnosed with autism is increasing, according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control. We learn more about the resources available to assist families in Maryland. We hear from writer and parent Alyssa Rock, whose teenage son Connor has autism.
So Connor, what do you want to be when you grow up?
A chef. I want to 25 language lane, and room 101.
So you want to be a chef, and you want to live on your own?
With my roommate.
So you want to have a roommate and live on Rambling Ridge Lane?
Then, how is autism represented in the media? We talk with an English professor who has studied characters with autism, such as Dustin Hoffman's role in Rain Man, and looked at how they affect our perceptions. First, the news.
The news in this case is that you're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. I'm producer Stephanie Hughes. Thanks for downloading us. You can listen to us live every weekday morning, except Thursday, on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WIPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. One in 68 children in the U.S. has been diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. In Maryland, the incidence is higher, one child out of 60. These statistics were released last month in a report conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and researchers from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. In a few minutes, we'll hear from the school's principal investigator for that report and discuss the findings with Dr. Rebecca Landa of the Kennedy Krieger Institute. But first, we want to get a picture of what it's like for one family who has a child with ASD and autism spectrum disorder. Alyssa Rock has two sons, Connor and Aiden. Connor is 15 years old, and he has moderate autism. Alyssa Rock interviewed her son, Connor, last week, and we learned a little more about him.
Okay, Connor, what would you like to talk about today?
To cook cake.
You like to cook cakes?
Yes.
What did you make yesterday with Ian? You need help? How about snickerdoodle cookies?
Yes, with Aaron.
What else do you like to do, Connor, besides cooking?
Arts and crafts.
Arts and crafts?
Yes.
What kind of things do you do in arts and crafts?
Mugs and bird feeders and bird houses and stools and crates.
You paint mugs and bird feeders?
And bird houses.
And bird houses?
And stools.
Okay.
And crates.
And crates. So, Connor, what do you want to be when you grow up?
A chef. I want to 25 language lane and room 101.
So you want to be a chef and you want to live on your own?
I want to 25 language lane and room 101 with my roommate.
So you want to have a roommate and live on Rambling Ridge Lane?
And I want Catherine Keene to live there with Connor at your new place.
Oh, you've already picked out a roommate?
Yes!
Oh, that's exciting.
You can do it when you graduate from school.
Yeah, we have to get through school first.
Sorry.
That's okay, though. You gotta learn things to be a chef, right?
Right.
What kind of things do you need to be a chef?
Good language.
Right, and what about your behavior?
Good.
Appropriate behavior?
Being appropriate.
Yeah.
Especially.
That's right. Thanks for talking to me, Connor.
Bye.
That was Connor Wade, being interviewed by his mom, Alyssa Rock. And Alyssa's with me now in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Connor is 15 now. When was he diagnosed with autism?
He was diagnosed at age 3.5.
And was that a long time coming? I mean, had you noticed things or?
He seemed typical until shortly before his second birthday. He regressed and lost a number of skills, his eye contact, his language that he had had. He was speaking in short sentences, and he stopped sleeping through the night. And so we began a year and a half long journey of specialists and different medical providers trying to figure out what exactly was going on with him.
That was in 2002. We knew less about autism spectrum disorders than now. What were the resources like for you then, for Connor?
Well, we were able to get him started on speech therapy and occupational therapy. There's a therapy, applied behavioral analysis. It took us a while to find out about that, and that's really intensive behavioral intervention. So I would say resources were hard to come by in terms of trying to figure out what exactly to do to help our son.
What kind of services does Connor get?
Well, over the years, we've done a lot of different things. We did occupational therapy, speech therapy. We also did a number of biomedical interventions with him. He had a special doctor that we went to Richmond, Virginia to consult with. We did a lot of work in our home with providers and therapists coming into the home for a long time.
But he's in school.
That's correct. He was schooled in our home for 6 or 7 years. And then he, when he saw his younger brother getting on the bus and going to school, he decided he wanted to go to school. So he goes to St. Elizabeth's School.
That's Alyssa Rock here on Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Alyssa, we're talking with her about her experiences raising Connor, age 15, who is on the autism spectrum. Your younger son, Aiden,
mm-hmm.
who's in fifth grade,
yes,
does not have autism.
That's correct.
Neurotypical is the scientific description. When he was old enough to observe that there were some differences between him and his brother, how did you explain that to Aiden?
I don't know. We've always just been very open and honest and frank with Aiden about his brother and his autism. It wasn't like we sat down and had a big conversation. We just said, oh, your brother has autism, and that means his brain's developing differently, but that's okay. And that's just Connor. That's just who he is.
What kind of impact do you think Connor's situation has on Aiden?
I think that it's been very overwhelming for Aiden. Our son has had a tremendous amount of behavioral challenges.
Connor.
Mm-hmm. And that means that Aiden has been targeted with aggression. He's seen a lot of tantrum behavior. Connor's behavior can be unpredictable in public sometimes. And as Aiden's grown older, that's been harder. Now that he's in middle school, you know, he's very socially aware. But Aiden is an amazing person, and he loves his brother very much. And we just all do the best we can to support Connor.
How does the situation affect you and your husband?
It's stressful, but we try to maintain our partnership. We're a team, and we both just really want the best for our kids and for, you know, obviously, to support Connor the best that we can.
You write a blog called Rock Autism Experience, and you write very candidly about you and your husband's experiences raising Connor. Why did you start the blog?
Originally, I started it around 2004, but just to keep friends and family kind of up to date about what was going on with Connor. Then I really started writing it in, I think, 2010 maybe, to really help people understand what the challenges were that our family was facing. I don't think everybody really understood what a struggle we were going through, and, you know, that we still go through, and why exactly it's so difficult sometimes to raise Connor.
What is it that you think people most don't understand about family life that involves autism?
I guess just that, you know, we're not just upset that our child's not going to, you know, ever be president of the United States. You know, there are very real everyday things that my son struggles with all the time. At 15, you know, still toileting can be a problem. Sometimes it feels like it's just a one-way street where I'm doing all the work in the relationship and I'm not getting anything out of him. And that there's an overwhelming amount of planning and routine that we have to follow to keep him on the level. So I think people don't understand kind of the day-to-day grind it can be. And, you know, I love my son very much. He's a wonderful person. But he does have a significant behavior problem, and that is also very difficult. It's difficult emotionally. It's difficult physically, trying to manage when he does have, at Kenny Krieger they call it a burst. It takes the emotion out of it when he has a burst. Because a 15-year-old, 130-pound kid having tantrum behaviors is very hard. So I think people don't understand that as much.
What would you like people to know about children with ASD? We were talking about families, but...
Sure. I would like people to know that children with autism spectrum disorder can have very fulfilling, productive, wonderful lives, but they need those support and the services from their families and their communities. And by that, I mean someone needs to help families afford the care that their child needs, whether that's social skills groups or whether that means in-home, awake 24-hour care for an individual who's more affected. I feel like our community is failing these kids in many ways because it is so expensive to give them the supports that they need, but that's what they need to be successful.
I really appreciate your giving us this look at it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alyssa Rock writes the blog Rock Autism Experience. She's got two sons, Connor and Aiden. Connor is 15 years old. He has autism. We heard from him earlier. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning about autism. I mentioned earlier the new report on the prevalence of ASD conducted by the CDC and researchers at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. They found 1 in 68 children nationwide affected by ASD, an increase of nearly 30% in the last 2 years. In Maryland, the incidence is higher, 1 in 60 children. Producer Jamila Kay spoke with Dr. Lee-Chin Lee, a psychiatric epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School. Dr. Lee is the principal investigator for the CDC's Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network in Maryland. She said it's difficult to tease out the factors that play into the increase in diagnosing autism year after year.
The increase is likely due to, in part, a broadened definition of autism spectrum disorder, greater awareness among the public and professionals, and the way children receive services in their local communities. It is very difficult, if not impossible, to tease these factors apart to quantify how much each of these factors contribute to the increase over time.
That's Dr. Lee-Chin Lee, a psychiatric epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School. And with us to talk about resources for children and parents is Dr. Rebecca Landa, director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, CARD, at Kennedy Krieger Institute. Dr. Landa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Dr. Lee pointed to a greater awareness of autism and a broader definition. Dr. Landa, do you see other factors that could contribute to this increased prevalence of autism diagnosis?
I think Dr. Lee has it right. I think we really have gotten better to tune in, so to speak, at the kinds of social communication difficulties these folks are having, being able to actually ask the right questions to understand the nature of their impairment around their social cognitive difficulties and also around these restricted patterns of behavior and interests.
And of course, autism disorder covers a spectrum. Are researchers seeing an increase in the number of kids who are high-functioning, low-functioning, Asperger's? I mean, is the increase sort of seen across the spectrum, or is it concentrated in one part?
What the CDC report is indicating is that the increase is in the children who are not having the intellectual impairments. It's the kids who are having, as you said, higher functioning.
That's where we're seeing the increase. The report says that boys are 5 times more likely than girls to be diagnosed on the autism spectrum. Do we know why?
We really don't. There is research looking into this to understand, is it something related to the sex chromosomes? Is it related to hormonal factors? We really don't have an answer to this right now.
Why does autism affect more white children than children of color?
For right now, I mean, there's certainly research going on looking into possible neurobiological factors, but right now we have to point to some factors that might be cultural, maybe the way that certain behaviors are viewed. So in some cultures, being able to entertain yourself and play without seeking out social attention from adults is not a bad thing. There's also difficulties in some cultural groups where maybe the mother is concerned, but there are taboos against her talking about it. So, I mean, these are complex things that we need to understand more about.
What went through your I mean, I'm sure you sort of saw this report gestating, so I guess you didn't have like a moment of, oh my gosh, but I mean, was there a moment like that when you were struck by something about the new data on incidence of autism?
Well, the biggest thing that hits me is that really autism is not a rare disorder, and that, you know, at least 1% of the population is affected with this disorder, and we really must be working extra hard to identify it as early in life as possible, because that's when the brain is most plastic. Then for kids who aren't getting identified early, and even for those who are, we need to be equipping teachers to really know what to do with students in their classroom who have this disorder in a way that's going to give them the building blocks for success in education and life afterward. I think we also have to equip parents with strategies for living their life with autism. You know, they have to be able to stay strong. They have to be able to get rest. They have to have a peer group. They have to have supports. And they have to be able to keep a positive attitude. And I know that sounds maybe impossible against some of the challenges, but we have to, as a society, embrace families who have needs, whether it's autism or anything. Another thing that's really important in the field of autism is to understand that when you have autism, very often there's a co-occurring other health challenge. That can be a GI problem, it can be sleep problems, it can be behavioral challenges such as aggression, self-injury, it can be epilepsy. It's important for physicians to keep their eyes open in their patients who have an autism spectrum disorder, just so that they're constantly monitoring whether one of these other things is hitting the scene and needs to be worked up.
That's Rebecca Landa, director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, CARD, at Kennedy Krieger Institute, here on Maryland Morning at 8:1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about new research and resources for parents with children on the autism spectrum. Dr. Li-Ching Li told us that kids aren't being diagnosed as early as they could be.
On average, children are diagnosed at the age of 4 years and 8 months in Maryland, even though the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder can be determined as early as age two. So there is much work ahead of us to catch up and close the gap.
Dr. Landa, how does early intervention affect a child's outcomes?
We have to think about what are the core impairments of autism. And it really comes down to, it's a social disability, there's difficulty learning the nuances of language, and there are fixations or tendencies to repetitive behavior. And if we allow a child to go on through development in the first 3 to 4 years of life with those difficulties and not intervene, imagine how year by year they get further behind their peers and less equipped to be able to establish friendships and to create for themselves the kinds of social interactions that really promote social and communication learning. We can change children's joint attention or social attention abilities, their ability to communicate effectively and to gesture and to learn to imitate other kids and to play with other kids. We can change that in a 1- and 2-year-old with autism.
You and I talked about a year ago. What is new since then, or more developed since then, in terms of initiatives and resources for children and their parents?
Well, one of the things that we've done is to create something for the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it's a 9-minute tutorial. And basically, it shows 3 pairs of 1-year-olds, one without autism and one who's showing signs of risk for ASD. And these videos are narrated, and so it points out for families and doctors what these early signs look like. So that's a really great resource.
Are we anywhere closer to understanding the cause of autism?
I think one of the big pieces of news is that the behavioral abnormalities come on very slowly and gradually in most babies and really aren't showing up in mid-infancy in the way that most people would expect them to. So the very earliest signs that something is awry actually involve the motor system, and they can be very mild signs, and they don't promise that you're going to have autism. But if there's a family history of autism and then there are these motor delays, even if they're subtle, families want to make sure that they connect with somebody who can give them ideas to strengthen their child's development.
Does that research indicate that we're going to be able to diagnose autism spectrum disorder even earlier?
Well, what we've found through our studies of infant siblings of children with autism is that 20% of subsequently born children to a family who already has a child with autism are going to have autism. And another 30% will have something milder, another type of language or social delay. And so through studying these baby siblings of children with autism from the time they're infants and until they're older, we actually can see what those risk signs are for autism. And I do believe that someday we will be able to identify babies who are going to have autism during infancy. Right now, we can identify babies who are at risk for having autism, but we cannot definitively diagnose autism in infancy.
I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Rebecca Landa is director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, CARD, at Kennedy Krieger Institute. A week from Sunday, April 27th, Kennedy Krieger will hold its 10th annual Roar for Autism fundraiser. We have more information on our website for those interested in biking, running, or walking to raise funds for autism research. And more of this interview and an extended conversation with Alyssa Rock, all at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. You can also hear Alyssa Rock reading from her blog. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us to see how autism is portrayed on screen. That's ahead on Maryland Morning 88.1.
You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. I'm producer Stephanie Hughes. Go to our website for more podcasts, audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org. Click the Maryland Morning link.
Everybody, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. We're going to continue our discussion now of autism. Many of us don't encounter people with autism every day, so we form our idea of the disorder from what we see on TV or at the movies or what we read in novels or in nonfiction books. One of the most famous portrayals of autism is in the film Rain Man, starring Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise.
Good morning. Coffee?
Yes, that'd be good.
Sally Dibbs, Dibbs Sally, 461-0092.
How did you know my phone number?
How'd you know that?
Said read the telephone book last night, Dibbs Sally, 461-0192.
He remembers things, little things sometimes.
Very clever, boys. I'll be right back.
How'd you do that?
I don't know.
You memorize the whole book?
No.
You start from the beginning?
Yeah.
How far did you get?
G.
G?
G, God's sake, William Marsh, God's sake.
You memorized G?
Yeah, G.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G?
G, half a G.
That's good, Ray.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
We hungry?
Yeah, Tuesday we have pancakes.
Pancakes? Well, yeah. That sounds good. We'll get some pancakes.
Maple syrup.
Yeah, you bet your butt.
Bet your butt.
So how do movies like Rain Man shape how we think of autism? What do they get right and what do they get wrong? Anthony Baker is a professor of English at Tennessee Technological University. He's written about portrayals of autism in the media. He also has a son who's autistic. Dr. Baker, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here, Tom.
So let's start with Rain Man. Dustin Hoffman won the Oscar for that movie, playing Raymond in the film, and he's a character who's an autistic savant. So what are your thoughts about that portrayal?
I remember watching Rain Man in the theater and loving the movie. I thought it was really interesting, and that was about 10 years before my son was born. And I remember on diagnosis day, my mind went directly back to Rain Man, and so it really has served as a focal point, or at least a definition point for me on defining what autism might be.
And of course, I think it's probably a defining point for a lot of people about what autism might be. But of course, as an autistic savant, this character is actually kind of exceptional, right? I mean, how common is it for people with autism to have that kind of dimension of the?
Pretty rare. It's pretty rare. I think I once saw a statistic that said it's lower than 10%. I'm sure it's much lower than that. So it's rare that somebody with autism will have the exceptional counting skills, mathematical savant, or musical skills, or the kind of memory that Dustin Hoffman's character has. So it's one problem is that this fictionalized example, and Rain Man was based on an actual character who was a savant, but it becomes kind of a shorthand for autism, and therefore Rain Man is autistic, so all autism is like Rain Man. And that's a problem because it raises different kinds of expectations and incorrect stereotypes.
So what other kinds of representation of autism are you seeing in film and television? Are there any representations that come to mind that are not taking the savant path, as it were?
Well, quite a few do take the savant path. It's quick shorthand. It's great for plots and shows from TV, crime dramas, legal dramas, and sci-fi shows, and even horror movies will quickly kind of milk autism for its savant residue or something like that. So it's that does kind of typify many of the examples of autism in pop culture. But I think there's another kind of trope or move that movies or TV shows or other uses of people with autism is when it's sort of the fish out of water kind of move where somebody with autism is removed from the comfort of the institution, like Rain Man, like Raymond was in that movie, or where a child with autism is quickly orphaned in some accident and then is somebody to be protected by the hero or protagonist of the movie or the novel even. And so I think in that case we have a kind of pitiable character and who is really almost helpless in the real world. And that's troubling for me as a parent when I like to see parents represented in these movies or novels. And when you kill off the parents in Act One, and it's kind of distressing for a parent to see, you know, or imagine his or her own child in that kind of situation. Of course, that's part of the appeal of the movie, is to, sure, to imagine a savior kind of coming in, swooping in and protecting the innocent.
So here's a clip from another film. It's called Mozart and the Whale. Josh Hartnett plays a character called Donald. He's a character with high-functioning autism, and he's talking with Isabel, played by Radha Mitchell.
Hi, Donald. You remember me?
Yes.
Good. You know what Gregory told me about you?
I'm good with numbers.
You spoiled my surprise.
I take things literally.
Me too.
One time when I was 7 years old, my dad took me to a diner for breakfast, and he said, how many grits? And I thought that he said, how many? And you know, I was supposed to count how many there were.
How many were there?
437.
So what do you think of that kind of portrayal?
Well, I think there's some savant skills certainly being portrayed there in Josh Hartnett's character, but that's a different kind of movie. It's a movie where the autistic character's not a plot device, really, and the autism isn't there to say, bring the Tom Cruise character in Rain Man out of his selfish shell. Rather, you have two people with autism who are going through some changes, and it's a lot richer. I think it's a lot more rewarding as a viewer to watch that kind of, it's sort of a romantic drama. There's some comedy in it as well, but it kind of shows a different side, a richer, a deeper side of what it might be like to experience autism. In that movie, we get some point of view shots where we see things from his character's point of view, and it really gives us a glimpse into another way of thinking about the world, and that's pretty valuable, I think, for a film to be able to do that.
Anthony Baker is a professor of English at Tennessee Technological University. We're talking about portrayals of autism in the media on 88.1 It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You're an English professor. Let's talk a little bit about books. One of the most powerful novels I've ever read is The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night The Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon, perhaps one of the most well-known books that takes up the subject of autism. What do you think about that book, and who else is writing about autism?
Yeah, I think Haddon's book is successful in doing exactly what I like about movies about autism, and that's taking us inside a character, and not in a gimmicky way, but rather in a way that really challenges the way we understand the world and go, oh, this is a different way of thinking. This is a different way of processing stimuli. This is a different way of processing characters and relationships. And so I think that's one of the reasons that Curious Incident is so popular. And that's probably, as you said, that's the biggest. That was out about 10 years ago. And it's first-person point of view. There have been some other first-person novels as well, young adult novels in particular. Rules by Cynthia Lord won the Newbery. It's first person from the point of view of the sister of somebody with autism, and she's having to kind of come to terms with her brother's fairly severe autism. And Mockingbird won the National Book Award for Young Adults by Catherine Erskine a couple of years ago, and its first person narrator has Asperger's, which is a high functioning form of autism. And so I think novels can be really good because they can use point of view to really take us inside a character's mind. It's hard to do that in film or in TV with any kind of depth. And so novels, especially young adult novels, have been kind of leaning in this direction and experimenting a little bit with narrative form. When you have somebody who processes the world a little bit differently, you can do some interesting things with chapter sequencing and experimenting with fiction a little bit too.
And we'll list those two titles on our website for folks who want to follow up. How would you say the depictions of autism compare to the depictions of other disabilities in the media?
I think it's autism, sort of the disability du jour. And so it's gotten, I remember when we first got my son's diagnosis in 99, it was not very well known. There was a lot of mystery, and I got a lot of questions. Oh, like Rain Man, what's his special talent sort of thing? But I think there have been so many uses of autism, whether it's in TV and in Parenthood. The character Max has Asperger's, and he's a recurring character. It's a very deep and interesting kind of use of that, or a character on Community, a sitcom which uses a character with Asperger's. People now are seeing autism or Asperger's in a lot of different ways, a lot of different angles, and so I think autism has really kind of, not exploded, but in the last 15 years really blossomed on the popular culture scene in a way that other disabilities might not have, but I think there are some problems still when you have, let's say, a wheelchair-using character on Glee, but the actor is not a wheelchair user. So there are some actors who have disabilities that I think, you know, it would be nice to have that kind of cinema verite where the actor himself or herself has direct experience with the disability and could be cast in some of these roles. I think that's the next step, and I'd love to see more of that.
You mentioned your son who has autism, Jake. Tell us about Jake.
Jake is a charming child. He just passed me in height in December, and he's growing like a weed on a very limited diet of pancakes, French fries, and other foods he probably shouldn't be eating. But he is a very, very happy. He is a sophomore in high school, has a lot of friends and others who watch out for him in high school. We have been worried, my wife and I have been worried a lot about potential for bullying, and Jake doesn't communicate very with much depth in conversation, and he's kind of trusting and gullible, and so he could be a good target for bullies, but he's really surrounded by a lot of good people in the kind of mainstream inclusive setting that he has at his high school. So he's just a charming kid, and we are much more worried. A lot of our worries are needless, I should say, as a parent at this point. His autism has really changed over the years as well. What he used to do, he's now developed other strategies and other, I don't know, symptoms or presentations or perseverations that have replaced his older ones. So it's been really fascinating academically to watch him change and his autism change over the years.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Baker, for sharing your personal story and the work that you've been doing observing the depictions of autism in the media. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Anthony Baker is a professor of English at Tennessee Technological University. We'll have a link to a book on autism that he's contributed to. That's on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. You can also catch our entire hour of programming here on autism. I'm Tom Hall. For producers Stephanie Hughes, Jamila Kay, and Matt Purdy, production assistants Cassandra Morales and Justina Latimer, and for Sheila and Nathan, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.